Today I'm giving a sermon that I think I gave about 10 years ago. I was kind of looking through my notes. It was one of those weeks where I was looking through to see if there's something I could give. And so if you've heard this before, I do apologize because it is something, but it's one of those weeks where I thought I would give one I'd given about 10 years ago. But when I was going through it, I was pleasantly surprised how much I enjoyed reading through my own notes as it applied to myself. So you might find the same situation. And if you haven't heard it, because maybe you're new or a visitor, or you weren't here 10 years ago, then for you it's a brand new sermon. But I did want to mention that in case you recognize some of the things here. But I did update a few things and add a few things up front. And I'm speaking about contentment today. And I wanted to start by giving you an illustration from Calvin and Hobbes. Many of you know Calvin and Hobbes, the very popular cartoon. And it goes like this. Calvin and his pet tiger, Hobbes, are walking in the woods when Calvin says, "I wonder why people are never content with what they have." And Hobbes responds with, "Are you kidding? Your fingernails are a joke. You have no fangs. You cannot see at night. Your pink hides are ridiculous. And your reflexes are nil. And you don't even have tails. Of course people are not content." Calvin answers, "Forget I said anything." To which Hobbes responds, "Now, tigers are not content. That would be something to wonder about." Now, this cartoon is meant to be humorous, but Calvin's comments highlight a truth about humans, the human nature, and that people tend to be discontent much of the time. And even if we had fingernails and fangs and good reflexes and tails like Hobbes, we wouldn't be content as what's being implied there. That seems to be the way our human nature has become. All of us at times have probably expressed discontent with something. Now, here are some examples. Maybe they ring true to you. Some possible things that maybe you've expressed about your life, or maybe you've heard other people say. One, it could be your surroundings. It says only, you know, maybe, especially as we get into this type of year, maybe if I only live somewhere warmer, a warmer climate, you know, maybe in Florida or California would be a place you'd want to live, and you're like, "Well, I wish we lived there," especially as we get the snowfalls and it gets below zero. Maybe you're wishing that. Maybe you wanted to live in a nicer neighborhood or a better house. Then I'd be happy and content. Maybe it's your job. If I only had a more fulfilling job and a better boss and more pay in a progressive and innovative company, then I'd be happy and content. Maybe it's your family situation. If only I was married, or I had kids, or maybe if I had no kids and wasn't married, I'd be happy. Maybe that's your situation, hopefully not. But, you know, you're always thinking, where we're at, we want something different. Maybe it's something about your physical appearance. If I was taller, or thinner, or faster, or didn't have to wear glasses, or had more hair, or had dark hair, or had light hair, or didn't have gray hair, or was healthier, or not sick. You know, some of those things are, you know, understandable, why you'd want to be some things different. But maybe, you know, we're unnecessarily discontent with some of our the way God made us. A bank account. You know, maybe if we had more money, or if only my savings or retirement was larger, then I'd be happier and content. Now, we could go on, and if we're honest with ourselves, we probably have thought similar things more often than we like to admit. And what is interesting is that we live in one of the most affluent countries that are abundant with resources in the world. Even though we have our troubles and things are seemingly getting worse in some ways, it's still, if you look at the whole world, the United States is a very abundant country. We have nice heated houses or homes or apartments and buildings and things like that. We have food. For the most part, very few people go hungry or are without things, although it does occur in this country. But for the most part, it's an abundant country. Yet, we seem like one of the most discontented countries in the world. Let's look at the example of Paul. Let's turn to the Bible and look at a statement that the Apostle Paul made in Philippians about contentment. I think it's very interesting and eye-opening. If you'd like to turn to Philippians 4 with me, Philippians 4. And we'll start in verse 10. Philippians 4 and verse 10. And here Paul says in verse 10 of Philippians 4, "But I rejoiced in the Lord greatly that now at last your care for me has flourished again. Though you surely did care, but you lacked opportunity. Not that I speak in regard of need. For I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. I know how to be abased, and I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me." Paul learned to be content in no matter what circumstance or situation he was in. And this is really quite a statement when you understand the events of Paul's life. First, Paul was writing this statement. When he's writing this, he was in Rome under arrest and waiting to learn his fate, where he would be let go or, you know, something worse, killed. Earlier in Philippians 1, verse 7, Paul says he's in chains. So he was in some kind of arrest, whether he physically had chains on him or not. He viewed himself in chains, under arrest. So he's writing about being content while in chains. Paul was in chains, yet he's also being criticized. Let's turn back to Philippians 1:12, and we'll learn a little bit more about the situation Paul was in when he wrote this. Philippians 1 and verse 12. And he says, "But I want you to know," and again this is Philippians 1 verse 12, "but I want you to know, brethren, that the things which happened to me have actually turned out for the furtherance of the gospel." And as we'll see, this is always the thing that Paul had in his mind. How is the gospel being preached? And if it meant that he had to suffer certain things for the gospel, he would do it. If certain things didn't affect him positively, but it still went forward, you know, he was happy about that. Verse 13, "So that it was become evident to the whole palace guard." So we get to see that he was in maybe having an impact on the people around him. And to all the rest, "that my chains are in Christ." So he was making some kind of impact to the people around him. "And most of the brethren in the Lord, having become confident in my chains, are much more bold to speak the word without fear." Verse 15, "Some indeed preach Christ even from envy and strife, and some also from goodwill. The former preach Christ from a selfish ambition, not sincerely, supporting to add affliction to my chains." So we see that in this case, he's actually being criticized. Some are critical of him for whatever reason. And yet, he's still having a positive attitude. Verse 17, "But the latter out of love, knowing that I am appointed for the defense of the gospel. What then? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is preached. And in this I rejoice. Yes, will rejoice." So we see that, you know, this is the situation Paul found himself in when he said he was learning to be content. And during this time, people were critical of him. And seeing that he was in chains, and for whatever reason, they took that negative view on that, and they were critical of him, and other things were positive. But imagine being in chains and arrested in an arrest situation, which is bad enough, but then to have those who maybe you knew or people that you trusted, maybe even your friends, to become critical of you and speak poorly of you. Yet, Paul, in this circumstance, he says he learned contentment. In Philippians 4, Paul says he knew how to be abased, yet be content. Let's look at 2 Corinthians 11 to see a summary of what Paul suffered throughout his ministry and his life and the commitment he had to follow Christ even through all those situations. If you want to turn to 2 Corinthians 11, again, we're just showing that Paul suffered a lot, yet he could stay content in the circumstance. 2 Corinthians 11, verse 23. We'll see here a list of things that Paul suffered. And I think this was read by Ethan not too long ago, but let's go through it again. It's very interesting to see all the things that Paul suffered. Verse 23, It says, are they ministers of Christ? I speak as a fool. I am more. In labors, more abundant. So he's saying he probably worked harder than anyone out there. In stripes, above measure. In prisons, more frequently. In deaths, often. From the Jews, 5 times I received 40 stripes, minus one. 3 times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. A night and a day I have been in the deep. In journeys, often in perils of water, in perils of robbers, in perils of my own countrymen, in perils of the Gentiles, in perils in the city, in perils in the wilderness, in perils in the sea, in perils among false brethren, in weariness and toil, in sleeplessness often, in hunger and thirst, in fastings often, in cold and nakedness, besides the other things which come upon me daily, my deep concern for all the churches. So he obviously was going through, he went through a lot of things in his life, and yet he also was deeply concerned about the church, and the every church area had its certain problems, as we read about maybe in Corinthians and other books of the Bible, and he was deeply concerned about their staying in the faith and false teachers. Maybe that was probably the most concerning to him out of all the things they went through. We also know he had to escape out of a window in Damascus. And later in 2 Corinthians, you know, later on in 2 Corinthians in chapter 12, verse 9, we see that Paul pleaded with God 3 times to have some type of physical ailment removed that he calls a thorn in his side. And yet God in his wisdom did not remove it. Paul knew hardships, trials, and difficulties. When he said he had been abased, he was not talking about a small, trivial setback or minor trial. He had serious, serious trials, and he knew what it meant to be abased. Yet, he says he learned contentment, whether he's abased or he abound, no matter what the circumstance. The Greek word for contentment has these meanings. It says sufficient for oneself, strong enough or possessing enough to need no aid or support, independent of external circumstances, and contented with one's lot, with one's means. Paul says you learn contentment during good times, as we've just read, or good times, or as we read about just recently, bad times or difficult times. In my observation, you know, is that being content, if a person's content really where they're at, it's really a sign of spiritual maturity. Spiritual people tend to be content. They have a deep understanding of God's presence in their life that leads to a sincere contentment. Contentment is important, is an important spiritual mindset to have. And today I'd like to spend some time exploring principles that we can apply in our lives to learn contentment and be more like Paul, who learned to be content no matter what the circumstance. So the title of my sermon today is Learning Godly Contentment, or Learning Godly Contentment. So I have several principles here. The first one is appreciate what we have. First principle for learning contentment is appreciate what we have. Now, I'd like to illustrate this point of appreciating what we have by sharing an illustration that I think we will appreciate and bring out the point of appreciating what we have. A lot of appreciations there. Anyway, but I have an illustration here that I think you'll enjoy. I won't use appreciate, but you'll enjoy, and I think it'll kind of bring out the point of appreciating what we have. And it's an illustration of a Russian lady in a crowded house. And it goes like this. A Russian woman lived with her husband and 2 children in a very small hut. Her husband's parents lost their home, and she was to take them in. It became unbearable for her. In desperation, she went to the village wise man who she knew had solved many problems. She said, "What should I do?" She begged. "What should I do?" She really wanted to know, "What can I do to solve this problem?" And he said, "Do you have a cow?" And she said, "Yes." "Then bring the cow into the hut too, and come back and see me in a week," said the wise man. A week later, she was back. "This is utterly," I don't know if this is supposed to be a pun, "but this is utterly unbearable," she says. "Do you have any chickens?" I didn't write this, by the way, so I can't take credit for it, but it's kind of clever if they put that in there. "This is utterly unbearable," she says. "Do you have any chickens?" asked the wise man. "Yes," she replied. "What about them?" And the wise man said, bring them into the hut too, and come back and see me in another week. Now you're out of your mind, said the woman. But nevertheless, she was in awe of the wise man's reputation, and she did exactly as she was told. And a week later, she returned. This is absolutely impossible, she said. Our home is a mess. All right, said the wise man, take out the chickens. Next week, she reported that without the chickens, it was definitely better, but still a miserable situation. All right, said the wise man, now take out the cow. This will settle your problem. And it did. Without the chickens and the cows, the woman, her husband, the children, and his two parents got along quite peacefully. So we see everything is relative. Sometimes we just don't know how well off we really are. This lady didn't appreciate her initial situation until her situation got worse. Then her original situation seemed pretty good to her. Often we get caught in the same trap. Instead of appreciating our current situation, we often are wanting something else to make us happy. How many of us have had a boss we didn't like or didn't care for until we got a new boss who was much worse? I've heard that lots of times. Well, the old boss wasn't really so bad after we got the new boss, and you have a new appreciation for what you had. Appreciating what you have is a simple truth. Yet, all of us at times have spent time dreaming about situations where we have something else, and we think of a result that will make us happy and content. Let's turn to a simple formula that we can find in the Bible to help us be content and appreciate what we have and what's been given to us by God. This is found in 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 16. 1 Thessalonians 5, and we'll start in verse 16. Again, it's very simple, straightforward instruction, but I think we'll see that we do this, it'll be a big impact in our lives. 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 16 says, rejoice always, pray without ceasing, in everything give thanks, for this is the will of God in Christ Jesus for you. It seems simple, but if we follow this instruction, we will tend to stay in the mindset that's appreciative and content. When we get off track, we stop being thankful for what we've been given. We want something else to bring us happiness. It's been my observation again that God tends to bless us when we have a contented and appreciative and thankful mindset for what he's given us already, as illustrated by rejoicing and praying and giving thanks to God. When we're like that, no matter what the situation, sometimes it's amazing how quickly our situation can change once we get into that mindset of being thankful for what God's given us. Let's look at maybe the ultimate example of a person who never found contentment, even though he had all the riches and material things he wanted. Person Solomon. Solomon increased in wives and concubines. Did that make him content? He increased in cattle, homes, land, gold, jewels, and his reputation also grew with fellow kings and queens. Did that make him content or happy? In the end, the more possessions did not make him happy or content. The book of Ecclesiastes, written by Solomon, writes about pursuing contentment through gaining in wisdom, treasures, and hard work. His conclusion is found in Ecclesiastes 12:8, which says, vanity of vanities, or one translation puts it, meaningless, meaningless. Everything is meaningless. That's the conclusion he came to. Ecclesiastes 12:8, if you want to write that down. It all became meaningless to him. All these things he had, in the end, didn't mean anything to him. In the end, all that he acquired was summed up as vanity of vanities, all being meaningless to him. Solomon essentially looked over all that he had and said, what's the point of all this? It didn't bring contentment or happiness. Did it make him feel content or happy? You know, all of us probably think, well, if I was Solomon or like Solomon in the same situation, I'd be a little different. Sometimes I think we think that in more modern terms. You know, we see these situations where people win the lottery, and they always have these stories of people who just it ruined their lives in the end of the day. And we all think, well, I'd be different from that. And maybe we would be. Maybe we would be a little different from the people that win the lottery and it ends up really messing up their lives and they lose everything they had ultimately, even though they've won millions of dollars. And maybe we would be different. Maybe we'd be a little bit wiser than some of the ones that do that. But I look back and think about our own, maybe when you're a child, and or maybe you have a child right now and you can kind of relate to this, but I think we can all relate that this human nature doesn't always leave when we get older. And as we see children, or remember when we were a child and we wanted that special toy and we really dreamed of it and we wanted it and we wanted it and we finally got our parents to buy it for us. When we finally got the toy, how much time went by before we wanted a different toy? We wanted something different. We wanted the new upgrade. You see people with their phones today. You know, they love their phone until the upgrade comes. and then they have to get the new upgrade. Yep. You know, they have this commercial now that's kind of funny where it's kind of making fun of all the iPhone users, which I have right here, who are standing in line, right, for days, and they're like, you know, they're all sitting there waiting for the new iPhone to come out. You know, meanwhile, somebody else is walking by with the Android, and they're kind of, you know, making fun of the iPhone people because people will stand in line for hours and days to get the newest one immediately, even though the one they have is pretty good. So I'd say we probably aren't that much different from Solomon. We think something will make us happy if we have something. We have the newest device, the newest phone, newest toy. It'll make us content. And maybe it does for a few moments, and later on we're back to where we were. Let's turn to 1 Timothy 6. 1 Timothy 6 and verse 6. 1 Timothy 6 and verse 6. First Timothy 6 and verse 6, it says, "Now godliness with contentment is great gain, for we brought nothing into this world, and it is certainly we can carry nothing out. And having food and clothing, with these we shall be content." So here Paul is bringing it down to really the basics. If we have food and clothing, that's, you know, all you really kind of need. But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare and into many foolish and harmful lust, which drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil, through which some have strayed from the faith in their greediness and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. And maybe you know someone like that. Maybe somebody has become rich, and over time, they're not in the church anymore. That is a risk of being extremely well off. Paul sums up real well, though. I think he says, having a spirit of godliness, you know, and that means, you know, thinking of others more than yourselves, having mercy, kindness, love, empathy for others, joy, and peace. You know, those are all make up godliness. And the mindset of contentment is a great gain. Godliness and contentment is a wonderful state to be in. I hope you have experienced this, and hopefully on a regular basis. Many actually experience this in the midst of a severe trial. You know, this godliness and contentment. And they can be in the worst trial sometimes, and they can find themselves in this attitude of or mindset of having a mindset of godliness and contentment, especially after fasting and prayer. Now, I've noticed that after the end of a fast, you know, and after the first, you know, as you come towards the end of a fast, you know, you have that initial hunger, you know, around midday, and that kind of passes, and you're kind of at the end of your fast, and you're sitting there, and you're kind of focusing on God, and you sort of feel all the daily struggles of eating food and pursuing things that you normally pursue are gone, and you're fasting, and you've been focusing on God and His nature and how much you need Him and how much of our physical needs get in the way sometimes, and by fasting we kind of recognize that. And I notice at the end of the fast, when this is the situation, we get a sense of calm and contentment, and it's very calming and reassuring. I think this is what Paul's talking about. You know, you have the godliness and contentment that comes as a mindset. Because I think when you fast, especially towards the end of a wine, you have that calmness, that clarity of mind that God's in your life, you can trust Him, and a peace and calm comes over you that is a sense of a mindset of godliness, a spirit of godliness, as Paul says here, and contentment. And that is great gain when we're in that mindset. Being appreciative of what we have and giving God thanks always for what he has blessed us with is a principle of learning contentment. We should always be thankful for what we have. Let's move to the next principle that I have here. And it says, and number two is, don't compare yourself with others. Don't compare yourself with others. An author, Paul Faulkner, in his book, Making Things Right When Things Go Wrong, tells of a small university that was having troubles keeping CPAs on their staff. Some CPAs could make twice as much in the business community that they could in teaching. The school finally had to offer a competitive salary. Other instructors became disgruntled. Rather than saying, isn't it great our school can finally keep quality teachers in the business department, they started to grumble. Why? Comparing themselves with others. Let's look at another example, and this goes back, I think, before 9/11, this example, but it still probably apply today. It says, several years ago, the firemen of New York City successfully negotiated a contract with the city. They were pleased with it until they learned that a new contract with the policemen had more benefits. Why the change? Comparing themselves with others is what they did. Has this ever happened to you? It's happened to me, in which I've been just like that. Now, I can go back, maybe I think this goes back a ways, maybe over 10 years ago, but I can remember a time back when people got raises. People had jobs and had raises. And at this point, you know, so this is going back a long time. I received a really good raise, you know, and I was thrilled. In fact, I was very happy. There was a pep in my step, a smile on my face, until what happened? I found out that someone else got a bigger raise. Immediately, my nice, big raise didn't seem so awesome anymore. What had changed? It's my attitude. The thing is, that I think it may have been a difference of a 9.9% raise versus a 10.1% raise. 0.2 difference caused me to be deflated in my raise. And previously, I was ecstatic. I thought it was the greatest thing. And because I found out through some circumstances somebody got 0.2 of a bigger raise, I became disgruntled. Maybe like the fireman, disgruntled. Wow, I really didn't get as much as I should have. Or the CPA, you know, at the university where the CPAs got paid more than the other, maybe the English teachers. It's pretty sad, but it's also a good lesson on what can happen when we compare ourselves to others. Surveys have found that people tend to look at those who make exactly double of whatever they make as rich, regardless of their income level. So someone who makes $30,000 a year thinks of someone who makes $60,000 is rich, and those who make $50,000 think those who make $100,000 are very wealthy. And those who make $100,000 think those who make $200,000 are rich. Just an interesting survey, interesting comment when you compare ourselves to others. According to an article from People in 2000, so this is going back again a ways, although I think it's a very good illustration, even billionaire Ted Turner struggles with dissatisfaction with his income. He said, it's all relative. I sit down and say, I have $10 billion. But Gates has $100 billion. I feel like a complete failure in life. This was back in year 2000, so maybe Ted Turner has modified his perspective, or maybe he caught up. I think Bill Gates has given a lot away, so maybe he doesn't feel that way anymore. But at least back in the year 2000, this is what he said. But it does show a common tendency to compare ourselves to others and how we view ourselves. If we compare ourselves with others, we're always going to be frustrated and discontented about our circumstances. Even Ted Turner, who had $10 billion, felt like a failure when he looked at what Bill Gates had. Paul seemed to understand these human tendencies. He provides a very instructive advice found in 2 Corinthians 10. Let's turn there, 2 Corinthians 10, because it's actually a pretty wise statement. If we follow this principle, it will help us avoid frustration and many other problems that come our way sometimes when we start comparing ourselves to others. 2 Corinthians 10, verse 12 says, "For we dare not class ourselves," meaning we don't, you know, segment ourselves of who's this person, and rank them, I guess, "or compare ourselves with those who commend themselves. But they measuring themselves," again, comparing themselves by themselves and comparing themselves among themselves, "are not wise." They're just not wise. Paul says, don't do that. It's just not wise to compare yourself to others. Ultimately, as we'll see, God gives each person certain gifts. And comparing yourself to other people is just not wise. Maybe you're being judged with different gifts than what God gave someone else. It's just not wise to compare ourselves to each other. Again, comparing ourselves to each other is not wise. And it does lead to disunity and contention. Let's turn to 1 Corinthians 12 and verse 12. We've got to get some insight here, maybe how we should view things. This is talking about the church, but it's something we could probably apply even outside the church in certain circumstances or situations. So in 1 Corinthians 12, verse 12, Paul says in verse 12, "For as the body is one and has many members, but all the members of that one body, being many, are one body, so also is Christ. For by one Spirit we were all baptized into one body, whether Jews or Greeks, whether slaves or free, and have all been made to drink into one Spirit. For in fact, the body is not one member, but many. If the foot should say, 'Because I am not a hand, I am not of the body,' is it therefore not of the body? And if the ear should say, 'Because I am not an eye, I am not of the body,' is it therefore not of the body? If the whole body were an eye, where would be the hearing? If the whole were hearing, where would be the smelling? But now God has set the members, each one of them, in the body just as he pleased. And if they were all one member, where would the body be? But now indeed there are many members, yet one body. And the eye cannot say to the hand, 'I have no need for you, of you.' Nor again the head to the feet, 'I have no need of you.' No, much rather those members of the body which seem to be weaker are necessary. And those members of the body which we think to be less honorable, on those we bestow great honor, and our unpresentable parts have greater modesty. But our presentable parts have no need. But God composed the body, having given greater honor to the part which lacks it, that there should be no schism in the body, but that the members should have the same care for one another. If one member suffers, all the members suffer with it. Or if one member is honored, all the members rejoice with it." The message, there's a lot here, actually there's a lot of messages here, but the message here that I want to point out is that we should appreciate each other's functions and gifts that we've been given. Paul makes an excellent point that the foot does not look at the eye and wish that it could be more like an eye. But together they provide functionality to the whole body. Together it creates unity and unison. Each one has to have a different role. Each one can do different things. But together, they function as one. And the foot doesn't compare itself to the eye, or the eye doesn't compare itself to the ear. And they certainly don't work differently from each other. They all work together. So everything has been put in place, especially in the church, for a reason. Everyone has different gifts, have different purposes. And we don't compare ourselves to one another. We just recognize that God put these gifts in the church, these functions in the church, for a purpose. And he has given everyone different gifts and capabilities. And we don't compare ourselves to each other. Comparing ourselves leads to discontentment and frustration. As St. Paul instructs, it's not wise to compare ourselves to another person. And it certainly does not lead to contentment. The third principle that I want to cover is find contentment in spite of your circumstances, not because of your circumstances. Find contentment in spite of your circumstances, not because of your circumstances. Often we look at our circumstances and view some future event or time as when we'll be content. You know, I think we can all remember we were in middle school. We couldn't wait to get to high school. That's when it was going to be fun. And then we couldn't wait to get out of high school into college or into a job out of high school. And then we couldn't wait to, you know, move on from there. We couldn't wait to get our first job or car, and maybe, you know, get married, have a house, have children. Always looking forward to some future event, and then we'll be happy and content. If we're not careful, if we're always looking forward like that to some future place where we think we'll be happy and content, instead of enjoying, we could really become discontented instead of enjoying the moment we're in. There's a very insightful, I think, poem or illustration here by a man named Robert Hastings. It's called The Station. You may have heard it before. I think it gets quoted, but it's a very, very well written. I'd like to read it to you here to kind of illustrate this point about always looking forward to some future event before we're going to be satisfied and happy. Again, it's called The Station by Robert Hastings. Just tucked away in our subconscious minds is an idyllic vision in which we see ourselves on a long journey that spans an entire continent. We're traveling by train, and from the windows we drink in the passing scenes of cars on nearby highways, of children waving at crossings, of cattle grazing in distant pastures, of smoke pouring from power plants, a row upon row upon row of cotton and corn and wheat, of flatlands and valleys, of city skylines and village halls. But uppermost in our conscious minds is our final destination. For a certain hour and a certain given day, our train will finally pull into the station with bells ringing, flags waving, and bands playing. And once that day comes, so many wonderful dreams will come true. So restlessly we pace the aisles and count the miles, peering ahead, waiting, waiting, waiting for the station. Yes, when we reach the station, that will be it, we promise ourselves. When we were 18, win that promotion, put the last kid through college, buy that 450 SL Mercedes-Benz, have a nest egg for retirement. From that day on, we will live happily ever after. Sooner or later, however, we must realize there is no station in this life. No one earthly place to arrive at once and for all. The journey is the joy. The station is an illusion. It constantly outdistances us. Therefore, yesterday's a memory, tomorrow's a dream. Yesterday belongs to a history, tomorrow belongs to God. Yesterday's a fading sunset, tomorrow's a faint sunrise. Only today is there light enough to love and live. So gently close the door on yesterday and throw the key away. It isn't the burdens of today that drive men mad, but rather regret over yesterday and the fear of tomorrow. Regret and fear are twin thieves who would rob us of today. Relish the moment is a good motto, especially when coupled with Psalm 118, verse 24. This is the day which the Lord has made. We will rejoice and be glad in it. So stop pacing the aisles and counting the miles. Instead, swim more rivers, climb more mountains, kiss more babies, count more stars, laugh more, cry less, go barefoot oftener, eat more ice cream, ride more merry-go-rounds, watch more sunsets. Life must be lived as we go along. The station will come soon enough. And there is a truth, I think, that rings true for me in that illustration. Enjoy today. Be content in what we have today. And not always looking for some future place we're going to be at. It's not always easy to do that. But let's be content in where we are today, in the situation where we're in. Not looking forward to when we'll be happy. The fourth principle I have here is understand that when we look to Christ to direct our paths and trust him, we can be content no matter what their circumstances. Let me just say that again. The fourth principle is understanding that when we look to Christ to direct our paths and trust him, we can be content no matter what the circumstances. Following Christ means not being content with our circumstances, but in our circumstances. Let's go back to Philippians 4, verse 11. Philippians 4 and verse 11, we see here Paul, he says, again, Philippians 4 and verse 11, we'll start in verse 11. Not that I speak in regard to need, for I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. I know how to be abased. I know how to be abound. So he had plenty at times. Everywhere and in all things I've learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. I'm sure Paul was not content with his circumstances at all times. In fact, he asked God to heal him 3 times. And I'm sure he would have preferred not to be in chains, but rather be with people, his brethren in Corinth or Ephesus. He hoped that his circumstances were to change, but he was content in the circumstance in which he was in. Now, how could he be content in his situation, yet hopeful that a better circumstance would occur for him? Paul had a deep understanding and trust that God was guiding his life and was in charge of his life. Let's turn to Hebrews 13. Hebrews 13. In verse 5, this sums up Paul's attitude and his approach. So even though he maybe didn't always appreciate his circumstance, he still could be content because he understood this one thing in verse 5 of Hebrews 13. He says, let your conduct be without covetousness. Be content with such things as you have. For he himself has said, I will never leave you or forsake you. So we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me? As a follower and disciple of Jesus, Paul got to the point he had total trust that Christ would never leave him nor forsake him and always take care of him. And that Christ had his best interests always in mind. This is something he learned. It takes time in our human skin, our human journey, to really understand that deeply. Paul got to understand that over time. This type of faith brings contentment. This is how Paul could find himself in a very, very bad situation and still yet be content in that situation. Paul was able to live above his circumstances and the things that happened to him in that content. King David wrote of the same idea of having a spiritual, mental, and physical contentment no matter what their circumstances, because he trusted God, his maker, and his shepherd. Turn to Psalm 23. Psalm 23, a well-known set of scriptures. But let's turn to Psalm 23 in verse 1. Some of you probably know this by heart. It says, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside the still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of death, valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. For you are with me, your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup runs over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Paul and David both got to the point where they did not focus on their circumstances, but learned to understand God was guiding their paths and their lives, whether it was in green pastures or in the valley of death. So they had a deep trust and deep faith that God was leading their lives. We cover a lot about being content in challenging situations, and certainly we all face challenging situations. But sometimes we can find ourselves feeling discontented even in green pastures. Maybe you have experienced this. Sometimes when things are going really well in life and situations are lining up in a remarkable way for us, we can still be discontented in those situations as well. And Paul did say he learned to learn contentment in being abased and in abound when he abounded. So it's 2 situations there. There's something we can learn from that. We learn to be content whether we're being abased or we abound and we have much. The key is to always trust God and be content no matter in what happening in our life. We're being abased or abounding in much. So I provided four principles on learning contentment, and they are: appreciate what you have, don't compare yourself with others, find contentment in spite of your circumstances, not because of your circumstances, and number four, understand that when we look to Christ to direct our paths and trust him, we can be content no matter what the circumstance. These are four helpful principles in learning godly contentment. However, there are some things we should not be content with. Let's give me a few suggestions here. We should not be content with our spiritual condition. We can never rest or think we've made it. First, let me just read this to you. In 1 Corinthians 9, verse 24, it says, "Do you not know that those who run the race, run in a race, all run, but one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may obtain it. And everyone who competes for the prizes is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a perishable crown, but we for an imperishable crown. Therefore I run thus, not with uncertainty. Thus I fight, not as one who beats the air, but I discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I have preached to others, I myself should become disqualified." You get the sense that Paul never got to a mindset where he was content that he had made it. He was not content to run a spiritual race and get second place. Second place is not good enough. We're all to run the spiritual race. We're all in our own spiritual race, and there is no second place, really. We all have to run as though first place is the only acceptable position for us. We cannot be content with anything else or any other outcome. It's first place, not a second place race we're in. So we can't be content with our spiritual condition. We also cannot be content with sin. We can never, never be content with sin in our lives. We must always be looking at ourselves with God's help. We remove the sin. We ask them to remove the sinful behavior, the actions, and thoughts that are in our minds. We can never be content with those things there. Matthew 5:48 says, "Therefore you shall be perfect, just as your Father in heaven is perfect." So that means we continually strive to be perfect. We can never say, "Well, I'm mostly good. I'm almost there, so I can be content. I can relax." We can never become content in our service to others. We can never be content with service towards others. 2 Thessalonians 3:13 says, "But as for you, brethren, do not grow weary in doing good. Many have served for 20, 30, or 40 years, and we can become content. Oh, I've done enough. I've been an usher for 30 years. Why would I want to be one for 31 years? Well, maybe you don't have to be an usher for 31 years. Maybe you give other people a chance, but you still keep serving. You still want to help out in some way. Again, the things we can do change as we get older, but the attitude of serving others, we should never be content that we've done enough in that area. Our mindset, you know, you think about Christ. Christ doesn't say, "Well, I died for humanity, and I can stop." If you think about it, Christ is still serving every one of us today. He didn't stop after his death. We don't grow weary in our serving others. Our mindset should never cease in how we can serve others, never grow weary in doing good, or become content that we've done enough. And actually, I thought of two other ones that we should not become content with as I was driving in. We should not become content with our relationship with God. We should not become content with our relationship with God. We should always be growing in grace and knowledge. We can never say, "Well, I've been in the church 40 years. I listened to the World Tomorrow program in the 50s, and I've read everything I can possibly read. I've read the Bible 15 times over." We never can become content with our relationship with God and growing and understanding grace and knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ. And I had one other one here. We never can become content with our relationship with others, especially our family, our husbands and wives, our children. No matter how good it is, it can be better. We should keep growing or keep working towards having the best relationship with our family members and others. We should never become content with those things. These are things we cannot become content with, but must continue to work to change and move forward in perfection. Paul learned godly contentment in a spiritual journey under very difficult situations. Paul would probably say that learning contentment is a lifelong process that grows from a foundational trust in Christ and his strength and not our own human wisdom or strength. And with God, all things can be overcome, and we can deal with all things in our circumstances with God in our lives. And that's the mindset of contentment. We are on the same journey as Paul. We will have some good times and maybe not some good times in our lives. This is the human experience in this age. It's not really God's world, is it? So there are good times, bad times. But we can learn contentment in all circumstances when we look to Christ for strength in all situations, whether we are abased or we abound.